In that way, we could ask the question like, who owns this land that we're standing on now? When I'm teaching in California, I think it has a lot more meanings because the land that I'm standing on when I'm teaching in California passed through a lot of different hands over time, a lot of different countries. Originally, who owned that land? The Indians had an ethic that the land belongs to whoever's using it. And where I teach in an agricultural area, there's a lot of land that just lies fallow, not being used for anything. But somebody owns that. You can't trespass on it. You can't go on it. The law is protecting the interest of some people, even though it doesn't seem to be too just to a lot of other people. And justice, then, or the meaning of justice, comes to have different meanings depending on the stage of society and the development of law, the degree of development of law in the society. And then on this other hand, we have as Christians this other sense of Christian justice and what that is. In a pluralistic society like ours, with a lot of competing interests, justice is defined as sort of compromise. And compromise means decisions are based on what gives the least offense to the least number of people. You know, think about abortion in this sense. The Supreme Court makes decisions about abortion. It balances competing interests, and that's justice. But you see, there's a lot of people that don't agree with that because the decision to compromise may not be, the compromise offends the least number of people, but in that sense, it also does not jive with probably most people's understanding of justice. In paternalistic societies, like monarchs, yesterday I was using an example of Samuel anointing Saul as king, and then the progression of kings in Israel. That if you remember the story of Solomon, where the wise King Solomon, the two women that were arguing about who owned the child, and Solomon says, well, divide the child in half. This is a paternalistic sense of justice. And in our families, that's the kind that we tend or try to impose on our children. You know, the children come to you, like my two kids, they're always fighting, always fighting. And so what decision can I make that will satisfy both of them? There isn't any. my idea of fairness is not necessarily their idea of fairness. Fairness, or the notion of fairness, breaks down in conditions of inequality, like the family is, where parents are more powerful than children, or where enslaved societies, or where there are any subordinate, superordinate groups, like in the work situation, the employment situation. And then there's also the legalistic conception of justice, and that's the notion that the legalistic culture, the culture of lawyers, judges, courts, and so on. The Oliver Wendell Holmes, one time somebody said, now be sure as a Supreme Court justice that you do justice, and he explained that doing justice was pretty much just applying the rules, playing by the rules. That's justice. And yesterday I made a major emphasis on that in a legalistic society, we see justice as due process, following rules. You got justice if the procedures were followed in your particular case. The outcome, you may not agree with, it may not be justice to you, but it is justice according to the definition that exists in this legalistic context. Well, the second point then, that I wanted to make is that justice without law, and I wanted to read these verses from Ephesians 2, chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. For he is our peace, who has made us both, this is kind of dim over here. For he is our peace, well, I'll start with the previous verse. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near in the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who has made us both one, and has broken down the dividing wall of hostility, by abolishing in his flesh the law of commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby bringing the hostility to an end. In other words, justice, unification without law. And what this means is that we all have a congruence in our own value systems, and that means that the community that we live in and our individual consciousnesses are in congruence. And what is our understanding? How can we bring that about? And that's sort of the question I wanted to leave you with, and we can pick that up afterwards. What are our Christian values? What does the Bible teach us about the values we as Christians push or should be pushing or living by ourselves as individuals to create this unity? Now, this movie is about takes place in a village in the bush of Liberia. And Liberia is the oldest independent country in Africa, in Black Africa. Liberia received its independence, was bought by the United States as an area for slaves to return to. And so the leadership, at the time that this movie was made, the authorities in Liberia were descendants from American slaves 100 years ago, or at the time of the capital of Liberia, Monrovia, named after President Monroe. The movie depicts dispute settlement in this village. And the reason I'm showing it is to show how this this transition from a legalistic or a pre-legal way of settling disputes to a legalistic way of settling disputes, and how the purpose of dispute settlement in pre-legal societies is to restore social harmony, cohesion of daily living. The purpose of dispute settlement, or the result of dispute settlement in legalistic societies, is to enforce rules, to show what the rules are, and which creates disunity and does not solve the problems of disparate or competing interests. So why don't we see the movie, and I hope we have some time afterwards for your reaction.
Deep in Liberia's interior, 150 miles from Monrovia, the capital city, and 27 miles from Bonga, the county seat for Bono County. All but a fifth of Bokwala's 2,000 people belong to the Fela tribe. The Fela are the largest of the 12 tribal groups that make up most of Liberia's population. I've done all my anthropological fieldwork here in Bokwala, a modernizing bush town in the Liberian rainforest. This film shows events as they actually happened in the lives of the people here. Folkwell's local government is headed by a town chief. Serving under him are 8 quarter elders, each of whom heads a residential quarter. Folkwell and several other towns form a district called a clan, headed by a clan chief. 2 clan districts make up a larger unit called a chiefdom, headed by a paramount chief. So Fokwala townsmen have 4 kinds of chiefs: quarter elders, a town chief, a clan chief, and a paramount chief. The chiefs, like their followers, are farmers. Unlike them, they are prosperous farmers. Such prosperous men don't live in the mud and thatch houses of ordinary folk, but in houses with corrugated iron roofs and cement-washed walls. These prosperous men have large farms, are more likely to raise some cash crops, and to own some cattle. Fokwala is unusual in having cattle. Most Liberian villages do not. But these cattle create conflict and tension between the ordinary farmers and the more prosperous cattle-owning farmers. Depu, like most Fokwala townsmen, is a plain farmer, as is Lopukwala, a medicine man. Yakbabu Kaofang is a young farmer, but Suakwala Jiao is older, a well-liked elder in his quarter. These men are plain farmers. They raise chickens and some goats, but none of them owns cattle. Folkwell's farmers work hard. Many rise before dawn and leave the town as the sun comes up. They practice a type of agriculture called slash and burn agriculture. This involves bush fallowing, where an area of the tropical forest is cleared to make a farm. That year, a crop is raised, and the next year, the farmer shifts to a new site. Rice is the main crop and the staple in the diet. A stew of vegetables or greens cooked in palm oil and flavored with red pepper is eaten poured over the rice. Meat is not plentiful, but sometimes the stew contains wild game, fish or chicken, or even less often goat meat or lamb. Beef, the people call it cow meat, is rarely available and is a great treat. At mealtime, women prepare rice for cooking by hulling it in a mortar and then using a winnowing tray, called a rice spanner, to separate the light chaff from the heavier rice grains. Among the fella, rice is used in important ways. Anything which endangers the rice crop raises anxiety, fear, and resentment. Folkwell cattle sometimes eat growing rice. This makes the cattle a source of anxious feelings because they may undo a farmer's months of toil. The town's cattle are the progeny of a herd started by Dole Campay, the deceased Paramount chief. They are owned by Folkwell's more prosperous farmers, including several chiefs. One of the prosperous cattle-owning farmers is Carboy, the town chief. Another cattle owner is Clan Chief Samuel Pay, the son of the former Paramount chief, Dole Campay. Like his late father, he sometimes sells one of his herd for cash income. His brother, Joseph Pay, a school teacher, is also a student at the University of Liberia. Sometimes he sells a cow to pay his tuition. 11 years ago, when Dole Campay was alive, the area containing his houses was fenced. The fence was not to keep out cattle, but to mark the boundaries of the chief's compound. Every 2 or 3 years, Folkwell townsmen representing each of the 8 quarters would repair and renew the fence. Small deputations came from other towns in the chiefdom to help with the job, which took 2 days. As a reward for the hard work, Dole Campay slaughtered 2 cows from his herd to feast the workers. This is one of the ways in which chiefs use cattle. Feast reward constituents who meet their obligations to the chief. At the Paramount Chief's compound, the cows were butchered and cooked. Wearing his black American-style hat, Dole Campay actively supervised the dividing of meat and rice into portions for each of the 8 quarters of the town and for the delegations from other towns. Men from the various quarters and towns ate separately. Later, Dole Campay explained the significance of the fence building and the feast. A chief must be as a father to his people, he said, and a father must feed his family. At the end of the feast, he washed his hands, knowing that he had used his herd wisely to carry out properly his duty as chief, to bind his people to him. Folkwell cattle are not fed, they forage. They eat scraps of unattended food. They also leave the town, often in the pre-dawn hours, to go to the farms to eat the rice and vegetables. Folkwell's farmers had taken measures to keep the cows from the crops. Stiles are built across the footpaths which go out to the farms. careful fellow farmers build fences around the farms to keep out goats and small wild animals which ravage the crops. But Folkwella farmers say they build their fences primarily to keep out the cattle, who are more destructive than the small predators. And the many hours they spend building the barricades, the farmers think angry thoughts about the cattle whose appetites cause such heavy labor. Folkwella people say that the gate across the motor road keeps the cattle from using the road as a route to the farms. 11 years ago, when Dole Kempay was alive, some farmers who hadn't fenced their farm found their rice crops eaten by a marauding bull. The angry farmers chopped the leg tendon of the bull, Dole Kempay's largest. The two young men thought to be guilty were temporarily jailed. Paramount Chief Dole Kempay asked an elder, Tokalon, the father of one of them, to find out who was really guilty. Tokalon gathered a group of elders to discuss the case. This case was serious. The chief said that he could place his spirit inside his cattle. Perhaps the young men were not really attacking the cattle, but attempting to murder him. One of the young men had difficulty raising the $200 which Dole Kempay asked as an indemnity for the two farmers' fault in the matter. The young man's mother and a kinsman pleaded with the chief to reduce his request. Crop damage by cattle is common, but it's rare for the farmers to wound livestock in retaliation, as the young men did. Such outbursts cause strain in the community, and people remember them. This time, the tension eased when the young man prostrated himself before Dole Kempay, begging for his mercy. At last, the chief accepted a reduced indemnity. One Sunday morning, we're filming people arriving for the service at Folkwella Lutheran Church. The congregation, mostly female, gathers one by one. Again, ordinary farmers and the cattle owners are in conflict. Cowboy is asked what he's going to do. This dispute, this palaver, isn't anything we can hear right now, he says. There's nothing to discuss. All we can do is to call in somebody to look into it. I can't hear a case where I'm one of the parties. We'll take it to the clan chief. Cowboy tells the people to put the calf inside a nearby unfinished house to shade it. He goes off to the clan chiefs. Someone has cut my cap and the people brought it to me. The tail was cut, Carboy explains. How badly was the tail cut? So badly that it's hanging off. The cap's right here in town, so you can go to see for yourself. Is that the cap? The clan chief asks. Yes, that's the one. The clan chief speaks of the earlier time when his father was living and another beast had been wounded. All right, says the clan chief. I'll reach the matter to Paramount Chief Uo. He'll probably send to the county seat for an ordeal operator and use an ordeal to find out who did this. The clan chief's messenger leaves to take the clan chief's request to the paramount chief. Carboy's anger subsides somewhat. He's momentarily content, knowing that action is underway. At the place where the clan chief and his friends are building a pavilion to dry peanuts, the discussion about the case continues. The usually affable Sua Kral Jiao says nothing. Will they be able to settle the case before the ordeal operator comes? They all know that an ordeal is a ritual for supernaturally determining guilt or innocence. In the Sasquatch ordeal, now outlawed, suspects drink a poison. The guilty die, the innocent vomit the poison. In the hot oil ordeal and the hot knife ordeal, the guilty are burned, but the innocent are not. The ordeal operator's ritual power works through the mechanism of the ordeal to select the guilty person. However, ordeals are seldom used in Folkwell. Most disputes are settled through the use of witnesses and cross-examination. Someone else observes that the cut on the calf's tail looks as if it had been made by a hooked machete. The men ask which of the people who farmed near the place where the calf was cut has a machete with a hook on the end. Perhaps, an elder says, the ordeal won't be necessary. Perhaps the guilty person will confess or give himself away. As the other men in Sua Kral Jiao measure out lengths of wood, everyone thinks about the ordeal. On the day set for the ordeal, 10 days after the calf was wounded, the paramount chief arrives, and we're almost out of color film. We use black and white. Wearing his Hamburg hat, Paramount Chief Hua walks through the town to the clan chief's compound and past Dol Kanpei's grave. The men sit on the porch talking about the case. In honor of the special nature of the occasion, the clan chief presents a goat to the paramount chief. This is to welcome him and to thank him for the special interest he has shown in the case by sending for the ordeal operator. The gift of meat expresses hospitality and loyalty. Cattle are used in the same way to express hospitality and loyalty to the most important political figures like the president and vice president of Liberia. When used in this way, the chief's cows are a source of prestige for all the people in the chieftain. The men's mood becomes more relaxed. They wonder what the film will look like. Your picture will go all the way to America, the clan chief says. Sure, says Wala, so will the goat's picture. We cannot talk about the ordeal. The clan chief has ordered the men who farm near the place where the calf was cut to stay in town to submit to the ordeal. The ordeal man is already in town. He arrived night before last. The men leave to go to Cardwell's place where the ordeal will be held. Wearing knickers and a pith helmet, the ordeal operator arrives with his interpreter. The ordeal operator, David Cannibal, is called, respectfully, Old Man David by the Folkwell townsmen. He's certified by the central government as a licensed ordeal man. He's a member of a distant tribe, the Crown. The old man uses a younger man, Matthew Kennedy, as his clerk and interpreter to translate for him, although he understands and speaks Bella well. The mystique of his office is enhanced by the fact that he uses an interpreter. People from all over town have gathered for the ordeal. The calf has died. Who has been daring enough to chop it, they wonder? Will the ordeal catch him or an innocent person? What will the chiefs, who are also cattle owners, do if the guilty person is found? Old Man David orders the clan chief's messengers to start a fire in the doorway of the unfinished house where the wounded calf died. He'll use the hot knife ordeal. The old man's paraphernalia medicine, not in the pharmaceutical sense, but in the supernatural sense. They're objects with supernatural power, which if properly used by a person with the requisite knowledge can bring about desired results. The most important of the objects in David's paraphernalia is the knife. It will be heated in the fire and held against the skin of the suspects. The innocent will not be burned. The guilty will be. The old man makes a magical gesture around the fire. Again, he makes a similar gesture. The knife is ritually prepared. The old man places a bracelet made of an inner tube to which is tied a feather on his wrist. Ordeal, the old man will rub his leg with the various magical substances and with water from the bucket next to him. Next, he will repeat the procedure, rubbing the various substances on the leg of the suspects. He'll rub his leg and then theirs with the hot knife. The Paramount Chief has selected a man to represent Folkwell. The aim is to decide first whether or not the person who slashed the cow is a resident of the town. If the man representing Folkwell is burned, this will mean that someone from Folkwell is the guilty party. If the proxy is not burned, this will mean that the guilty person is a resident of some other town. When the proxy steps forward, the old man will address him through Kennedy, his interpreter. If it's a football person who cut the cow, this knife should catch you, the old man says. But the ordeal should not catch you for other things. If you have a witch backing you, a big fetish backing you, or anything else magical backing you, the ordeal should not catch you for that. But if it's a folk world person that cut the cow, then the knife should burn you. The Paramount Chief says, if you know anything about this wounded cow matter, don't move your leg from there. Magical gestures with four red feathers emphasize the chief's words. David strokes his own leg, then the proxy's. There says everyone he's burned. I'll call a person slash my cow. Test the suspected farmers one by one, say the chiefs. Wait, says old man David. There's a man who came to see me last night. His name's Suapal Jao. Ask him what he proposed when we were all alone. Be quiet and listen, the Paramount Chief shouts. The old man's telling me something important. You children, get back. Suapal Jao, where are you? Come forward. Kennedy interprets for old man David. The old man says Suapal Jao came to him last night. Jao said, I want you to help me. I'm the one who cut the cow. Then he offered the old man $2 to use the ordeal to show that someone else was guilty. What? Exclaims Paramount Chief Hua. Who in this town is such a slave that the old man should take the clobber from your head and drop it on theirs? No one, murmurs Jao. Perhaps you want the ordeal to catch me, mocks the Paramount Chief. Suapal Jao speaks in a low voice. The thing this cow did is too much. The way it's been eating rice on my farm is a terrible thing. His excuse is not sufficient, exclaims Clan Chief Bay. Why didn't he bring the matter to me? How can I settle my people's palavras if they don't bring them to me? You're right, says the Paramount Chief. Suapal Jao should have laid the matter before you and asked you to take it up with Carboy. Then you could have asked Carboy to pay Jao something because of the rice that the cow ate. The Paramount Chief orders his messengers to detain Jao until he, the chief, can determine what indemnity should be paid to Carboy. The messengers haul Jao back and forth, holding him up as an example to anyone who would take the law into his own hands. Carboy explodes. It's a terrible thing Jao did. Since he didn't take the matter to court, he's forfeited any claim to compensation for the rice. The crowd scatters. The culprit has been revealed. And old man David leaves, his energy spent. next morning, the rainy season downpour resumes, and we use our remaining color film. The townsmen return to their normal routine. There's relief and satisfaction that the ordeal has worked. The supernatural principle has operated properly. For the people of Fokral, the utility of the ordeal has been demonstrated again. Most people are confident that the ordeal would have turned out the same way, even if Suokwala Jiao had not confessed beforehand. We anthropologists speculate about the ordeal mechanism. Does the ordeal operator sense tension as his fingers stroke the suspect's legs? And what do his eyes, hidden by dark glasses, watch for? But the tensions between cattle owners and ordinary farmers remain. The farmers never know when their crop will be devoured by the cows, when the well-being of their families will be jeopardized. Nor can farmers be sure if this happens that the chiefs, who themselves are cattle owners, will always give them fair redress. So the tensions remain, as do the cows, and the farmers' knowledge that from time to time, the chiefs will see to it that the people can garnish their rice with beef from the cows of Dong Kenpei.
Do you have any response or any questions or comments that you'd like to make?
What happens if the ordeal doesn't reveal guilt or pain?
Something's wrong with the medicine someplace, I suppose. Is the failure of house prophets is a very common incident in the Old Testament, you know, where God's prophets against the king's prophets. And in terms of foreseeing the welfare of the society or explaining phenomena in one sort or another. The ordeal is an interesting thing. One of my colleagues was doing research in West Africa, and he had two houseboys, one a cook and one that took care of his laundry and things. And he noticed that his razor blades were missing from time to time, and it didn't bother him very much. But he complained about it one day, and he realized he shouldn't have complained about it, because he complained to the person he complained to, one of his servants, denied it vociferously. "You're accusing me of doing that, and I didn't do it." You know, and he says, "That's okay. I just wanted to let the word out that this was going on, so that it would stop." And so this guy got all incensed and called for an ordeal operator to prove that he hadn't done it. Mm-hmm. And so they had the two fellows that were the suspects, and it was the same thing, the hot knife ordeal. And my colleague explained it in terms of, a person who's innocent, pain, we're just beginning to understand pain and how it works, and so much of it is subjective. And he said that you could tell who the guilty party was right away, because the guy that wasn't guilty, he was, you know, proud, and he just put his leg in the circle, you know, like that. And the other guy was tentative. You know, he gave himself away. So if people believe in these origins of justice, they're going to reflect that in the way that they themselves personally relate to them. But I could run the lights, someone turn those on.
Well, this
not going to. You can do this experiment yourself. Sword swallowers or people who put matches or things out in their mouth. You can do that too. It's not a very difficult thing to do. There's a coating on. They coat skin with something. It's like jumping out of the, getting this out of the sauna and jumping into the cold water. There's an instant where you can't feel it, but then you really can. So the idea is, if you have this layer of something, you can touch it briefly and it won't burn you. You notice that when you're eating hot soup or something too. I'm not going to put a totally natural explanation on this, but I don't think they'd leave it on there until there was a blister. You could see that they were just brushing the leg. But the walking over hot coals, those types of things, that Hindus do. There's similarities to that too, in terms of natural explanations. But you have to have the confidence in order to do it in the first place. if you've ever watched somebody eat a razor blade or glass, and like one of your college roommates or something, and you have to have the initial craziness to want to try it to see that you can do it. I went back to the issue of justice though. You see how the satisfaction in finding the guilty party here is emphasizing the underlying principle, of course, is to emphasize the power relationships in the community. And that's the law is serving these interests. Of course, in the Western United States, we had the similarity of the farmers and the cattle owners, and the cattle owners wanting their cattle to have the free range to graze, and the farmers building fences. And so you have these range wars. Now, you can predict the directions that village is going to take. You see, the weak farmers are going to have to figure out ways to get law on their side, too. And that's why I said what that guy needs is a good lawyer. Because, and how will this develop? What happens, unfortunately, in these communities is that as the state develops, it serves the interests of the local chiefs. And so people pay taxes, but then the tax monies are used for the benefit of the powerful. And so the legitimacy of paying taxes is lost. People aren't going to pay taxes if they don't see it benefiting them, or benefiting them equally with other people. Think of all the problems about welfare, public welfare, people paying taxes to give money to people who can't work and don't want to work and are just living off the rest of us. In their society, it's going for the needs of the chief. And you can see that. In our society, you find some of the same things, where the roads are built, where the public works projects, who they serve. In California, we have these eternal water problems. And Ronald Reagan doesn't pay any taxes, and he gets a lot of water. And the small farmers don't get that water. And it's the same, in other words, there doesn't seem to be a lot new under the sun. As I was saying yesterday in some of these things. So we can see the same things happening in our society. Well, I was asking before the movie where Christian justice comes into this and how, from what we're taught as Christians, we're asked to violate these principles of worldly justice, of equality. We turn the tables or we are asked to give of ourselves in service, to give up our interests and our motives toward domination of power, and to align ourselves with the powerless. I think that the best statement that, not the best, but you can see our church, my grandmother, her dear old self, who lives in St. Paul, sent me this article out of the St. Paul Post, or Press, Pioneer Press Dispatch. This is from the last ALC executive, or ALC Church Council that met in St. Paul in June. ALC takes a stand on civil disobedience. In other words, in support of civil disobedience. In support of violation of the law, in other words, from time to time, depending on the particular case. But I wanted to read you from Matthew 5, something that you've probably heard quite often. This is from the Sermon on the Mount. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Now, these are what are known as the Beatitudes. But when I was growing up, and probably for most of my adult life too, I really had trouble understanding the meaning of these things. What does this mean, these statements, these Beatitudes? They aren't true. They have no worldly truth to them. What is the message to us here? They don't make sense on the surface of them. They just aren't true. And slowly, and with the help, of course, of preachers and teachers over time, I came to see that the way these are stated, they lead up to a culminating point, and they're really leading up to what the role of ourselves as Christians and the church is in the world. And you notice that the first verses all talk about involving ourselves with the powerless, with the mournful, with people who have troubles. And it's saying that to really live, this is the excitement of living, is to align ourselves with these people. To align ourselves with the opposite, with the powerful, is death. It's not real living. I'll go back again. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. Involving ourselves with those who are in mourning, we really come alive and feel of a purpose in our service. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Have you ever known people who hunger and thirst for righteousness? They're people who are really alive. They're people who are active. People who are not satisfied. People who are striving and progressive in their lives. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Again, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. People who strive to align themselves with this one purpose toward leading the Christian life. And then blessed are the peacemakers. All of these people are those who involve themselves with the issues and the people who generally are despised in our societies. The people who are on the outside, who we're generally disunited with. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of God. And it goes on, and then it ends up with saying, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trodden under foot by men. You are the light of the world." In other words, this is our purpose, and to pursue this type of justice, to be a signal to the rest of the world this way. And the Bible doesn't give us any hope that we're going to achieve our ends within this life, because the values of the world, the justice that the world understands is not this type of justice. And it goes against our common human experience. So really what we're being asked to do here is to make this leap of faith into something that really violates common sense in a large respect. But we find by doing that, or when we do that, that we actually come alive. Do you have any responses at all? Yes.
In the movie, had the farmer not been so unwise to injure the animal, but had captured and returned it to its owner, he would have then been repaid for the damages that the animal caused?
Well, we don't know. At the end, the chief who owned the calf that was killed said, "Well, if you had come to me, you know." Well, that sounds like what I say to my kids after the fact, too. you should have just told me about it. You know, I'm sure. The reason they didn't tell me about it is because probably I never listened. And that's, I think, probably what these farmers, they were saying that the farmers probably have done, the chiefs know this about their cattle. It's interesting that I thought, too, yesterday when I was reading a portion from Samuel, and it says where Samuel grew old and his sons took over for him. And his sons rode around apparently on opulent saddles, on the best camels, and display their wealth through the countryside. And it says justice they was lost. They were not performing justice. And it's interesting in this movie. It says that the original chief who had the original herd was looked at as a good and just chief, but now his sons have taken his wealth, and of course, when they sell the cattle, some get to go to college. There's, in other words, a lot of inequality in the distribution of wealth in the community, and it's growing. So I, you know, you can say that damages. There's a lot of social damage that we don't think about in any community, in any society, because we consider it to be just appropriate. You know, for example, when McDonald's comes into a community, everybody wants a McDonald's in their town because of all the commercials and everything. So city councils or planning commissions usually allow McDonald's to build wherever they want to. Communities are starting to get wise about this now, to see how this harms the community in many respects, how it takes away jobs from those people who have to support families, and gives jobs to teenagers at reduced wages, how it litters the community and makes for a lot more work, including keeping the community clean, how the architecture of McDonald's violates a lot of community aesthetic values. You can think a lot about how we allow social damage to go on that's not retrieved. In other words, that we don't think, it's like, you know, the cattle eating the grain. We don't think, or we think that, well, this is just the way things are. And, you know, this is what we live with. Maybe you can think about some other examples this way, too, of kinds of social harm that is unredressed, that we just assume is the case, or should be the case.
Didn't the owner of the calf have any responsibility in keeping it out of the other guy's property?
Well, one would assume that.
I mean, he didn't seem to. I mean, it's like he didn't have any part of it.
The problem is that cattle have no place in that society.
So it wasn't really any of his doing.
It's like off-road vehicles, you know, when they're invented. They haven't been around before. You know, so people drive them all over the place, and they rode the countryside. And then some people start thinking, hey, wait a minute, don't they have some responsibilities toward preserving the countryside with those things? And so then maybe some rules are made up. But you see, the cattle were introduced into that culture, and as I said, they had never been there before. And so they were causing a lot of damage. And we can sit here and say sure, you know, those. The cattle owning farmers have a responsibility, but they depend on the cattle, and they forage, as it said, in the movie. That's the way they eat. It's kind of like it's kind of like the old range wars. Yes.
I was a volunteer in Liberia for 2 years with my wife. We just got back in January, and it's a real common sight in those towns to have either goats or sheep just wandering about in the town. And like they said on the film, they'll sometimes get out into the forest, but a goat is not going to cause that much problem. So people just assume initially that the cattle should have the same right as the goats. The cattle eat a lot more rice, and cause a lot more damage.
That's true. You can think of a lot of comical examples, I think, in our own society, where, you know, we put up with we in some sense are dependent on things that harm us, like the automobile. We don't seem to be able to get along without it, but it's killing us. Yes?
I think that cattle are a good example of a source of power that a few people have acquired and they don't know how to use it, because a lot of the other countries in that area, the Fulani are herdsmen who do have a specific kind of cattle, and they really shepherd them. And they may be wild, but they really do respond to the herdsmen's whistles and cues. And it's interesting that you don't usually see cattle in a village, it's usually in the direction of herdsmen.
I think that's very true. I was going to say that there are, in Eastern Africa, there are these tribes that where the ecology is combined, you know, I mean, it's where the cattle stop and the humans begin isn't really clear, because they live with and depend on one another so much. Where the cattle are basically the reason for being for the tribe, and they trace ancestry through the cattle, and their lives are the economy and the ecology of their lives are intertwined with the cattle.
And if they lose their herd, like they have recently with all the rentipets, then many of the herdsmen will commit suicide because they have no recourse for any livelihood in the future for some.
Does anybody else have any comments? Well, why don't we go to lunch then? If you want to talk about anything else, I'll be here too.
What is the difference between the building?